board meeting back to order, and we will go to the information items, which is the 2019 state issues update. Danielle.
Danielle Coates is going to introduce our guests today. So, Danielle.
Good morning, President Sullivan and members of the board. It is my sincere pleasure to have the opportunity to introduce our newest lobbyists. But as it relates to this item, every year we invite our state lobbyists to come and present before the board so you guys can hear from the boots on the ground and allow them the opportunity to do a little prognosticating on what we anticipate this next year to look like and some of the emerging issues that we're already seeing. So again, it's my honor and pleasure to introduce Jamie Miner and Aaron Namella of Namella Pappas & Associates, our Sacramento advocates.
Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for allowing us to be here today, and thank you for entrusting your agenda to us. It's really an honor to be serving the district. So my name is Aaron Namella. This is Jamie Miner. My business partner is in contact, but she just had a baby. That's Emily Pappas. Otherwise, she would be with us here today as well. We thought we would start by just kind of telling you kind of 30,000 foot about us a little bit. Emily and I joined into a partnership. We're in our fifth year now. My experience, I spent 17 years in the legislature and then working for legislative leadership, and then opened up a sole practitioner practice, and then Emily was a partner for a decade in another lobbying firm. Prior to that, she worked for a governor, she worked for President George Bush, and then we were all grateful that she ran into Jamie, who was working for congressional leadership. She actually recruited Jamie into her prior firm, where she and Jamie worked alongside each other, and we were lucky enough for Jamie to join us as well. Jamie is really our water expert. And you'll understand why when you hear her speak. We also have another associate who has a tremendous amount of experience in fundraising and also some legislative work. And then we have another consultant that we retain in addition to our admin staff, who was a longtime partner of Emily's when she was at her prior firm and has 40 years of experience working in the Capitol building, including for leadership. So with that, I'll turn it over to Jamie to talk a little bit about how we work with our association.
Yeah, and I know Paul, you know, mentioned obviously you guys work closely with both CMUA and Aqua, and so fortunately, you know, we've been working on water district clients for many years, so we've gotten to build, you know, really good relationships with both Aqua staff and CMUA staff, and you know, it's great that we're co-sponsoring legislation with them this year. We've worked in prior years on the water consolidation issues, on water conservation issues. We have weekly meetings with Aqua that we attend, and then in addition, on this water tax issue, there's a subgroup of folks that meet to kind of divide up members and work on the opposing the water tax. So we've been working really closely with them and coordinating with them, and have been having done that for years. So it's pretty seamless in jumping in on your guys' issues. So, and then we'll talk a little bit about what the political dynamic is this year. I know you guys all saw election results, but we'll chat a little bit about what that means for us and what we see as far as legislation.
So as you well know, we have a three-fourths, nearly unprecedented, majority of Democrats in the legislature. In raw numbers, that's 61 Democrats and 19 Republicans in the lower house in the assembly. 55 Democrats and 25 Republicans. Oops, that's not right. we actually don't have 55 Democrats. We have 29 Democrats. In the Senate. Basically, the dynamic that we're seeing is that the way that we influence legislation in most cases is around the margins. And the way that we affect those margins is in lobbying moderate Democrats and Democrats who are unaffiliated with traditional Democratic constituency groups. And really what that means is in this new world in which California has an open primary, and in a world in which both of the parties have more a diversity of opinions than they used to have, there are a number of electeds who represent perspectives that traditional stakeholder groups have not endorsed. And so we see a lot of Democrats who've been elected to previously Republican seats with marginal victories who were backed by business groups, who were opposed by unions. Those are the kinds of differences that we are seeing, and what we are finding is that those legislators tend to be more independent from the things that normally constrain members of the caucus. And because of that, we can have conversations with them that we wouldn't normally be able to have because we can be heard. They have to be independent. That's how they got there. That's how they will retain their seats. Because of the way that that backing candidates in elections has changed over the years in Sacramento, leadership doesn't have the same tools available to them to keep members in line, and there are many more of them. And so that changes the dynamics of the conversation. And as we continue to work with you all in developing strategies, you will see that be a common thread in how we are attempting to address outcomes. We wanted to talk a little bit about the governor and his priorities. That is another big change in our world. Most of the legislature has been used to Governor Brown sort of dictating the agenda. Many of the folks who are in the legislature now either were elected after Governor Brown, his term ended, or they were elected when it was already clear he was in charge. And so it was difficult for them to sort of flex their political belief system and establish their priorities. Now with Governor Newsom, there is sort of a new sheriff in town. And the legislature is more of an equal branch than it once was. For starters, the legislature can veto any of the governor's priorities with a two-thirds vote. In this case, they have members to spare if that were something that they decided to take on. That's virtually unprecedented, but it is possible. And so that changes the way the legislature and the governor deal with one another. Governor has set forth a number of priorities. In his first version of the budget, we expect a revisit in May, and they include some pretty high price tag priorities: universal preschool, the expansion of health care coverage, free community college, 6 months leave for new parents, the expansion of a working tax credit for low-income workers, and then, of course, as we all know, clean drinking water for all. All of these priorities are things which moderate Democrats are looking at as, in some cases positive, but also providing additional pressures on the general fund. In addition to that, moderate Democrats, many of them under Brown, decided to vote for, were compelled to vote for a gas tax, which many of them knew at the time was politically unpopular. Many of them were against it. And there were repercussions. At least one Democratic senator was recalled directly over this issue. So many of them are looking at that issue as sort of the canary in the coal mine. They are viewing that as a litmus test for reelection in fiscally conservative districts, which many of them inhabit. And so we believe that portends a discussion on the water tax that starts with the position of many moderate Democrats having opposition to the water tax, or at least uncertainty. And so you will see that that will be a part of our strategy going forward. And with that, I will turn things over to Jenny again to talk about appointees.
Yeah, I know Paul mentioned some of the appointments that have come out, you know, just in the past week, hot off the press from the State of the State address. But it shows a lot, you know, where the governor is on a lot of these issues, that he kind of wanted a clean slate when it came to climate change, to resources, to water. And obviously Governor Brown had put a lot of autonomy into all these different board secretaries and agency directors, and so I think, you know, Governor Newsom wanted to set his own precedent and make his own policy objectives, so kind of clean the slate. So you know, he talked a little bit about Laurel Firestone, who was the most recent appointment. She comes from the Community Water Center, who will, you know, mostly be aligned with environmental justice advocates, given her Community Water Center position. She testified, or she had somebody from her former commission or coalition testified in the same hearing that Paul did, was very vocal about the need for a safe drinking water fund, and specifically for a tax, because it's the most sustainable measure. So we can see her really, you know, continuing to push that, along with our new chair, Joaquin Esquivel, who again came from working with Barbara Boxer and a lot of environmental groups. But many look to him as somebody who's pretty open-minded, who seems to be a little bit more moderate, because he, you know, is concerned about the impacts on ratepayers specifically. So there was a pretty controversial vote at the end of last year on the Bay Delta Plan, and it was taking away a lot of funding for, or sorry, a lot of water flow and water allocation from farmers, and instead letting it go to the ocean for, you know, the environmental purposes, for the fish population. He was very moderate in his approach to that, and actually Senator Feinstein wrote a letter endorsing his approach as opposed to Felicia Marcus's approach, and asked for him to be appointed chair, and so that ended up happening. And we also saw Wade Crowfoot, who is now our Natural Resources Secretary. He used to work for Governor Newsom way back when he was in San Francisco. Then he went to EDF, EDF, an environmental group, NGO, and then was, you know, in Governor Brown's office, and then was at the Water Foundation, which was really instrumental in putting forward the past few years a water tax and a safe drinking water solution. So I think we'll continue to see, you know, that it's no surprise that on the first week of the governor's administration, he went and visited a town where they didn't have safe drinking water. This is one of their major priorities, and as evident in their first week's action. So, yeah, I think we can continue to see that. And then just what we see in general from the state board under Governor Brown's administration, you know, in the midst of the drought, the board really expanded its authority and its jurisdiction on a lot of issues, whether it was just via the administration or the legislature continuing to give them more power and ability to regulate water districts, water use, etc. So I think we'll continue to see that trend, you know, number one, being a push for a water tax. They want additional funding. In the budget this year, they asked for 23 new positions just to do the research on what it would be to, you know, consolidate districts, to identify the districts that are failing, that don't have safe drinking water currently. So they'll continue to push for that funding, and they've expressed interest in having a tax. A lot of people speculate it is because they want that mechanism set up, especially on water districts, so that down the road, should they want to fund additional programs like LIRA, which is the low-income rate assistance program that I know you guys have been actively watching, you know, that will cost money. So who pays for that? And if there's something on the bill that you're already, you know, able as the administrator and the billing agent, if you're willing to collect that revenue or able to collect that revenue, then it's easier for them to tack on down the road when those programs come forward. So the human right to water, you know, letters were just due last week on making making water a human right and implementing that, and what does that mean, starting with the low-income rate assistance. Similar to what we see for energy users, there is a public purpose goods charge that you see on your energy bill. There's nothing like that for water, so they're trying to figure out how to do that. Who implements it? Who collects the money? These are all questions that your associations and your agencies, you know, weighing in on, but we'll have to see how they deal with it. And then the implementation of the, you know, kind of landmark water conservation bills that passed last year, SB 606 and AB 1668, you know, allocating specific water budgets and water use for each district based on climate and a number of factors. So they're really the ones that, with that bill, they got a whole bunch of new authority to develop new urban water use efficiency standards, you know, upon which a local efficiency objective will be based. So a lot of just jurisdiction there. They'll develop the tools, the data, the templates for how, you know, we are supposed to comply with that, or how local agencies comply. Water recycling, they've been directed in the past years to continue to come up with definitions of how potable reuse is regulated, you know, in addition to just the purple pipes, how to take that a step further, so they have a lot of authority to, you know, wade through the research and come up with certain objectives and water quality standards that an agency would have to meet. So they'll be active on that this year. And then wetlands, this has been a pretty controversial issue, especially recently, because they're deliberating it right now, but they've issued a draft staff report, which basically changes the definition of wetlands, or waters of the United States, to be much more expansive, and it's not aligned with the current federal definition. So it brings a lot of uncertainty for, you know, any watershed. The definition is so broad that, you know, ag is pulled in, and any just kind of puddle. It's a joke, but it's kind of true. That's how unclear the definition is currently. So water agencies, along with others from industry, are working really closely to help narrow that definition and work with staff to, if there is a gap between the change that the federal administration has put forward and what the state wants to do, you know, how do we find that middle ground and cover the gap, but still allow for some certainty for folks that are doing CEQA and doing environmental review of projects. So that is actually the first week of March, they're bringing that to the board. So we'll see some resolution on that pretty quickly. So yeah, that's kind of what's happening over at the Water Board more than ever, and I think we'll continue to see that trend and have new folks to get to know. And you know, but generally we feel good about the board members in place and the relationships we have there. So where we need to, we hope to affect change or at least get forward what our priorities are forward. And then just a little bit about our exciting bill. I'll turn it to Aaron.
Well, actually, I think we think we're very well positioned right now. You know, the smartest thing you could have done in this environment where you have a new governor on an old issue, and governors have a tendency a lot of the time to get their way, is to kind of lean into the curve, to find an alternative that achieves his same purpose, which is precisely what you've done, and also meets the political objectives of so many of the electeds who will be the core decision makers on this issue. And as a result of that, what we're seeing, of course, we have our author, Senator Caballero, on the Senate side, who is the author of both the trust issue and the restructuring issue, the consolidation issue. We have her leading the charge within the Senate, which is exactly what you want, because you are avoiding a fight between the houses. It makes it a lot harder for the Senate to champion a position that is for a water tax. So that is excellent. The other piece of that is it has created a dynamic in the Assembly where there is much less certainty about a water tax. And that is because you now have an alternative out there. And no assembly member wants to be who is concerned about being perceived as being pro-tax, wants to be put in a position when there is another bill out there in the other house, potentially authored by somebody in whose district they are nested. They don't want to be put in a position of voting first for something that will not be viewed as positive by their electorate. And so the dynamics are perfect to have the right kind of conversation on this issue, and it's really because we've achieved in this proposal, you have achieved in this proposal, the objective that the governor has set forth, that the prior governor set forth, that the advocates for, you know, improving water quality have set forth, but you have done it in a different and more responsible way that meets the political objectives at the time. And so we have gotten very positive feedback, including, you know, very high-level leadership staff and some of the key voices in particular in the upper house, and we think that's positive.
Questions?
No, I'm just curious as to how workable or educational Laura Richardson would be. You know, I think everybody wants to give people clean water, but at some point, you know, you have to have wet water to give them any water. And, you know, sometimes I don't think that resonates with some of the environmental folks. And so hopefully, you know, that conversation can be had with her.
Laurel Firestone.
Yeah. Laurel Firestone, I'm sorry. Yeah. Because I do think that Joaquin understands that. And so, you know, if we need some time with her, you know, to have that conversation, yet you have no water, you know, what do you do with these folks? Because if you can't recharge the overdrafted basins where all these things seem to be, you know, it's worthless. Those people would have to move. I mean, there's got to be some argument for them to understand what water districts like ourselves or others up in the Central Valley have to deal with. And I don't know whether she's going to listen to people that are on the ground that understand what you have to do and what's needed in order to supply that water.
Yeah, and I think that's it's a key difference between this administration and the last administration is you have the environmental community and then you have the environmental justice community. And I think Joaquin and Laurel are more from the EJ front. So I think, you know, you don't see them weighing in as much on the Bay Delta flow. Well, I know it didn't impact our region directly. You know, it does because it sets the precedent because then there's, you know, stage two of the Bay Delta plan, and that will come our way. So, you know, that was just flow for fish. It was purely environmental, and you saw Joaquin really have an open mind on it because I think he saw what it would do to Central Valley communities, to the farming communities where a lot of these, you know, disadvantaged folks are. So I think there is a key difference, and with Wade, Laurel, and Joaquin kind of at the helm over on water issues for Governor Newsom, I think you'll see more of a transformation to the environmental justice side versus Felicia Marcus used to work for NRDC, didn't only care about the fish, but you know that was where her priorities were and where that our former governor was.
The other concern certainly is I think for most all the water agencies are going to be, you know, what the state wants to do with their version of the waters of the U.S. Right. It's been a long time, and what's currently going through the federal government that's on the Federal Register is something that most everybody on the western United States has helped formulate because we got to have water supply. And when you're so regulated that you can't have water supply, it defeats the purpose of what the EJ community wants. And so it's going to be an education process here before the state jumps off a cliff and wants to re-regulate everybody. This has been a long time coming. And I hope somebody realizes that.
I think if we were to characterize, and I know you know this, if we were to characterize where we are in the legislative session, we would say we are in the part of the session where you're kind of playing footsie. You're laying an educational foundation for folks to help them find the path to get them where you need them to be. And so right now there's the kind of public dance of, oh, we have a bill, we have a position, and then the public statements that we've heard in some of these oversight committee hearings, particularly the one on the assembly side. But that's all positioning. Basically, folks are putting their game pieces on the table, and they are connected to other gain pieces because people have other asks that are unrelated to water. And so what our job is going to be, as you've correctly pointed out, is educate folks as much as you can. They may or may not give you the positive responses you want because it's their job to hold their cards close unless they're already on your team. But behind the scenes, our job is when they get to that decision-making point to make sure the politics are right so they end up in our corner. That's the task. And we think this conversation, actually given the dynamics around the budget, it's possible it could happen in the budget. One of the things we have discussed and recognizing we're in a public meeting, but you know, one of the things we have discussed is making sure we haven't removed options for the legislature to agree with us, that there should be a trust and that trust might have to be have a general fund investment. Well, once you get past the budget process, your opponents will say, oh, it's too late. We can't find that money now. We've already charted out next fiscal year. So part of our job is to anticipate a response like that in late July or August, late July behind the scenes because they're not meeting, or August, and play our cards now so that we have reserved the option of having those general fund dollars so that they can't preclude the trust later on in the year when we offer it behind scenes as an alternative to the tax. So there's the public piece of it. Everybody's got their, you know, positions and they're squaring off. But then there's the behind the scenes piece, which is we don't want to preclude our option by not taking the right steps now. And that's what we're going to be working on in the next 2 weeks.
Any questions?
I don't have any questions.
Okay.
Thank you for the time.
Thank you very much for your time. Welcome to the district.
Excited to be here.
Okay. With that, we'll go to the Wine Country Infrastructure Update. Joe. And Brian, I'm sure.
Mr. President, members of the board, we wanted to provide you with an update on our Wine Country Infrastructure Initiative. Where we're at and some of the considerations going forward. I should mention that our initiative is supported by multiple departments, including finance, the special benefit assessment area, Charles and his team, the planning department, Brian Powell and his team, as well as development services, Corey Wallace and his team. So this is a multi-departmental initiative. We also have with us today Eva Pleasure from Rancho California Water District, who has also been an important stakeholder in this effort as well. In terms of background, in 2010, the county was advancing the Wine Country Community Plan. And as part of that plan, given the limitations on the groundwater basin and the limitations as far as the magnitude of development that can be accommodated with on-site septic, the county approached EMWD and essentially requested that we look at advancing a sewering infrastructure solution to Wine Country. We worked closely with the county and we embarked on a significant public outreach effort as well to the various vendors. Ultimately, that culminated in us advancing the project. We did require at the time project participation agreements with the proposed developers or vendors. We had a threshold. We had a threshold of 400 equivalent dwelling units that would have to be committed to connect to the system before we advanced the project. And we did gain that. So upon getting the required support from the vendors, and upon entering into a financial participation agreement with the county Riverside, where they committed $5 million in support of this solution, the district embarked upon the planning, design, and ultimately the construction of this solution. So phase one of the project was completed in 2015 and included significant amounts of gravity sewer infrastructure along Rancho California Road, as well as Cal Contento up to Butterfield Stage. We also constructed a significant amount of force mains as well as two sewage lift stations. One of them is adjacent to the Wilson Creek Winery, the Loma Vergosa lift station. The other is the Armada lift station, which is pictured here on this slide, which is along Rancho California Road. The system was designed and can accommodate approximately 4,400 equivalent dwelling units. That's a significant amount of development. The phase one cost was approximately $25 million that we incurred, of which we have received to date $2 million from the county in reimbursement, $3 million funding from the county remains that they are committed to in support of phase two of the project, which I'll describe here shortly. Phase two is estimated to cost $7.2 million. Thus, the total cost of the project is approximately $32 million. So we established a special benefit system to reimburse the district for those costs that we advance in support of this phase one as well as the future phase two effort. So the special benefit assessment was established initially at $6,300 per equivalent dwelling unit. There is an annual adjustment for inflation that occurs, and currently that SBRT is $6,700 per equivalent dwelling unit. This exhibit, the red outline, shows you the extent of the special benefit assessment area, whereby when developers and property owners connect to the sewer system, they will pay the facility participation charge and then the special benefit assessment as well. The purple line shows the extent of both the phase one as well as the phase two sewer infrastructure, including the two lift stations, the Loma Ventosa up here next to Wilson Creek, as well as the Armada lift station. So to date, we've had about 500 equivalent dwelling units participate, either by connecting or entering into the financial participation agreement. We've received approximately $2.7 million in reimbursements through the special benefit assessment. But in addition to those that have connected, which are highlighted here in the dark color, there's also a significant amount of development within the SBA that is in various stages of development and entitlement. And there's about 1,153 equivalent dwelling units that are talking to us and the county about advancing. So we're very optimistic that there will be significant additional connections that will take place within the SBA. So looking at the phase two infrastructure that I mentioned that has yet to be constructed, there is an extension of the sewer from Wilson Creek further up north to a proposed development, a 12 Oaks development that will take place over here. There's also smaller developments along that alignment. So this color represents the phase two extension, as well as we will need to relieve certain limitations or bottlenecks along Nicholas Road. Those two areas of improvements essentially represent the phase two improvements, estimated to cost approximately $7 million. We have had a number of discussions with the County Riverside. They are ready to budget the remaining $3 million over a couple of years to accommodate the phase two improvements when they are needed and when they are triggered. In fact, we met with Mr. Juan Perez late last year, and they're fully committed to the remaining financial participation. So this slide represents some of the ongoing developments within the area. I mentioned the 12 Oaks development, which is currently in design. It is a phased development with phase one that includes a resort, and phase two includes estate lots. Roarcar Ranch is also advancing. Although they are outside of the SBA, they will be contributing wastewater that will be discharged along Nicholas Road, and thus we will keep monitoring that situation because that may trigger us to make the improvements downstream along Nicholas Road. And there's other developments as well, Austin Vineyards, Oak Meadows Ranch, and Bailey's Ranch. We're working with all these developers as they advance through the entitlement phase. So moving south, there is the Wine Country South along Highway 79. And if you recall, back in 2015, we did a study jointly with the Rancho California Water District to look at what would be the infrastructure solution for the southern Wine Country area. And we looked at the ultimate buildup of the southern Wine Country along Highway 74, and that's what this delineation represents. We estimated at the time that there could be as much as 3,700 to 5,000 new equivalent dwelling units that would connect to a sewer system. Based on that, we developed the infrastructure requirements, including the extension of the sewer along Highway 79, as well as lift stations. But ultimately, what this amount of development would require is, in fact, a parallel sewer along Highway 79 all the way down to the Pala lift station, as well as an upgrade to Pala lift station. The magnitude of those improvements were estimated at somewhere between $24 million to $32 million back in 2014-2015 timeframe. That study was completed, however, there were no specific timeframes for implementation. Having said that, recently, several developments have approached the county, as well as EMD, interested in advancing their projects, and specifically Galloway Downs, as shown here on the exhibit, as well as Di Portola Estates, located up here, KPC, which includes a mixed use of commercial and residential. So these developments are interested in advancing through the county planning process. And we've had a number of discussions with the county, as well as the Rancho California Water District, as well as the regional board, and how we can collectively develop the appropriate conditioning to be able to allow the developments to advance while also protecting the groundwater basin that serves Rancho California Water District. And at the same time, developing a solution that is sustainable long-term. So looking at these objectives, we believe so far we've been very successful in having a phased approach in conditioning these developments. So currently, the county will allow development to proceed as long as the septic systems is no more than 1,200 gallons per day per parcel. And that has been one of the tools utilized by the county to be able to advance these developments. They have made a point to refer all such developments, be it in the southern White Country or within the SBA, to EMWD, as well as Rancho, to review the conditioning and provide our input accordingly. So that coordination, that collaboration has been very effective. So from our perspective, knowing that these developments are advancing, we looked at the downstream sewer along Highway 79. And if you recall, the sewer was funded, or the existing infrastructure was funded by Assessment District 159 many, many years ago. When we look at the remaining capacity of the system, there's anywhere between 3,000 to 3,700 equivalent dwelling units remaining. Having said that, we accounted for the remaining commitments for AD 159. I'm not sure if they'll materialize, but if they do, that leaves anywhere between 1,300 to 2,800 EDUs remaining within the system. The reason this is important, because we believe that beyond looking at the built-out conditions in southern wine country, there is an incremental approach to serving the immediate developments that are coming forward. So it may not require the full implementation of a sewer infrastructure solution all the way down to Pala. There may be an opportunity to utilize the existing capacity, extend that sewer, work with the development community, and have a more incremental phased approach to the development activity in Southern Washington. So that is our current perspective. We believe there is an incremental phasing plan to the sewering solution for Southern Wine Country. What we are recommending as next steps is to continue coordinating with the county and RCWD regarding the development inquiries that are occurring, make sure that we condition them appropriately. Beyond that, we want to coordinate with the county relative to the remaining funding participation in phase two of the Wine Country infrastructure along Rancho California Road. We want to make sure that we receive the remaining commitments in time when those improvements are triggered. But what we're also recommending as we go forward is that we advance a infrastructure phasing plan for the Southern Wine Country. Beyond the high-level study that was done back in 2015, we believe there is an incremental phasing approach to the southern solution. We believe that such a plan would be very helpful in serving as a roadmap for our development service team and our planning team in being able to condition development as they come forward. So with the board's concurrence, we will be working on developing the scope for such a plan, and we'll bring this back to the board's consideration at a future meeting. With that, I'll be happy to answer any questions, and I don't know, Eva, if you wanted to make a comment.
I do want to say thank you, Mr. Ward. word again to the Eastern staff. They've been working with us on this issue. As Joe mentioned, the Temecula groundwater basin that underlies Wine Country provides drinking water to 150,000 people. So it's a critical drinking water source for us, and we appreciate Eastern's support and commitment in keeping that basin healthy. That's a good supply of water. So thank you very much, and really appreciate it. It's been a pleasure working with Eastern staff. You have a very good team. So we look forward to resolving this this issue. Thank you.
Are there any questions?
Yeah, my question is, the advancement, the $3 million from the county, is that to help facilitate our study, or is that for the first increment of actual hard cost for a line for construction?
That would be for the northern infrastructure within the SBA. So that there's still
for phase two,
there still remains improvements along Nicholas Road that will be triggered in the future, as well as the extension of the sewer further north towards Twelve Oaks. So that represents phase two, and the remaining $3 million will be in support of those improvements.
Right. Okay. My original question kind of back when was to, on phase one, do we have a significant reserve already in case there's no hookups for 3 years, that this doesn't hurt our finances?
Charles?
Because there hasn't been the amount of hookups that was originally discussed with us, and everybody seems to now want, you know,
sure,
another financing vehicle or whatever. So I'm just curious, because we did this with some bonds, I think.
Let me give a little bit of background. Okay. So when we formed the SBA, I believe it was in 2012 was the year, we originally intended to fund the Eastern's contribution with an SRF loan. That was our original intent. Then when we worked with the state, we realized the timing was not going to work out for us. So we evaluated our funding resources and realized that also issuing additional bonds for this specific project really wasn't economical for us either. We had reserves available at that time to be able to cash fund this project. So we actually cash funded the sewer infrastructure related to the Wine Country component. There are other sewer infrastructures in the region that we also funded that with bonds. So it might be that the timing was such with downtown Temecula, some other projects we funded with bond proceeds. The Wine Country specifically, though, was funded with reserves. So we don't have a bond component related to that.
Okay.
We did form an SBA. It was a large number of EDUs assumed over a time period. And we did take certain risks associated with the pay down of a component for us. Basically what we're saying is we fronted the funding for it, anticipating funding reimbursements over a time period. We also recognize, though, that there's opportunity costs for the district. Giving up our capital to invest in this does have a cost for our ratepayers, and we're expecting a partnership with the development community over time, and that they would pay us back respectively for that interest loss that we would have in our opportunity to invest. So we incorporate that into our financing component. So we created not only a funding mechanism for them to pay us back their FPC fee, the connection fee as they develop, but also their special benefit arrangement. They could finance that component and pay us back. So to date, we've connected a variety of EDUs for the winery, so they're connected to the main gravity line. It's in line with the original intent that we'd have at least 400 to initiate the program, but we still have a ways to go to reimburse us for the entirety of the initial investment. And I think we envisioned that our absorption of all of the units would be over a 20-year period. So we're still chipping away at it, but it will be probably a 20-year program until we get fully reimbursed for all the EDUs for the district's investment.
That I understand, but if we were to say that we expect a reasonable investment upon our money at this point in time, and we had no other development for the next 2 or 3 years or not, the amount of hookups that we would hope, you know, are we... Let's just say that we had a bond for it.
Yeah.
And use the bond as an example of this is our investment for the board. Would we be negative today, or would we be negative next year? I don't expect the answer
sure.
today, but I think that the board needs to see that at some point.
as someone that says to phase two, hey, guys, we're not having a great luck here because we're financing this ourselves. And you haven't made your commitment if that happens to be the case. So what are you asking us for phase two when you haven't performed on phase one? To me, that's just good business sense. Okay. So,
what we can do.
And do we want to help and do some things for everybody down there and for Rancho? Absolutely. But should it be on our ratepayers' neck right now? I don't know. You know, maybe we want to do that, and if people have a real interest in doing something, do you mind leaning your property? You know, to me, it just comes down to some business ethics as to what we do. So you can bring it back to the board.
So we can do is we put together the schedules to show what those costs have been, and then what the contributions have been to date. Yeah. And then what the remaining responsibilities are. And we also had schedules when we initially formed the SBA that talked about that. So we can compare that to the initial.
Sure. And we can also include, you know, where we are right now and then look at the major development projects that are in the SBA right now and the anticipated timing and lay those in as well.
Yeah. But that might be a reasonable update for the wine growers out there and the other folks to say, hey, this is where we're at. We're either doing a great job or, you know, we could use some improvement here.
Sure. Okay.
Yeah, that's easy for us to put together.
Okay. Other questions?
I'm going to get back to Joe.
Yeah.
I didn't hear great from the
other Great.
And I do want to clarify that what we're recommending as far as infrastructure phasing plan is to help serve conditioning of future developers.
And I fully understand that. Absolutely. And I think it should go forward. But to implement something, you know, we need some other answers is all I'm suggesting.
Any other questions I can answer?
So the county has indicated their support of the changes to the community plan.
Changes to the community plan?
The increased densities on the by 79.
So that was always part of the community plan.
Oh, it was?
Yes. The original community plan encompassed both the northern area as well as southern America. But at the time, the greater interest among the Bittners was for the northern area along Rancho Bonifacio Road. The southern area is somewhat different. There's a greater amount of residential, equestrian, and, of course, Bittners. But the mixed use in the southern area is different than the northern area. So the focus back in 2010 was on the northern area and trying to advance an infrastructure solution for the northern area.
Okay. But it was, you know, I don't know exactly when it was. It was 12 years ago, perhaps, something like that. We were concerned about the sewer capacity on Highway 79 South.
Yes.
And where we actually said, hey, you know, we're not going to allow any hookups, I think it was for 6 or 8 months, until we finish what we're looking at here to see if we had to run a dual system. And at some point, you know, I can't remember what the decision was, but we've done this before, and I think it would not be favorable to hold somebody up again for 9 months. Well, we finish the study. That's why I advocate doing what you're doing. But
absolutely. And you're correct, Director Sullivan. We had some capacity limitations downstream of Paula. So we're currently under construction with the dual Paula force main to separate that system to regain some of that capacity. So we're already well underway to address those limitations.
Okay.
Any other questions?
Terrible having a memory. Okay.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Thank
Joe.
You. Thank you, Joe. Okay, with that, we'll go next to item 5C, which is a budget workshop. Number one, assumptions. Charles, it's your lucky day.
I cleared the room.
So we're now officially kicking off the budget season. So as the board knows, we do several workshops as we develop the budget. But the first of those workshops starts with laying out some assumptions for the budget. So staff can then go back and start to construct a budget that would be brought to the board for consideration over the next few months. So Charles is going to go through kind of our initial assumption list and where we are and get comments from you. And then, again, this is an information item, so we'll be bringing things back in future workshops for discussion and then the finalization of the budget before the end of the fiscal year.
Great. Thank you, Paul. So, as Paul just mentioned, this is a series of workshops, and we do like to have some interaction here, so we appreciate your input and feedback throughout this process. We'll come back. I'll go through the timeline and initiate it. But before I do jump into the presentation, just want to acknowledge our staff here, Gary Mullen, Donna Kamiki, and Casey Lee are really the ones making the budget happen. So I want to thank them. And they're all with their pens and pads of paper taking notes. We cover this when we'll be back for our next workshop, but I want to acknowledge them making this all come together. So, as Paul mentioned, we have a variety of items. We're going to just jump right into it, but we will cover the key assumptions today. And then on my next slide, I'm going to talk about what's after this and how we're going to put the whole budget together. But really, our focus today is on the expenditure side of the budget. We'll talk more about revenues, rates, things like that at our next workshop. So today's really focus on where do the funds go and give you a kind of an overview of that. So on slide three, we're talking about our budget schedule. So here we are today, our first workshop, key budget assumptions, again, focus on the expenditure side. On March 20th, we're scheduled to come back for a workshop to talk about our operating revenue and expenses, our capital biennial budget, and our preliminary rate adjustments. So this is really, again, a summary level of the budget, so you can get a feel for where we're headed based on your input, as well as what we're seeing with all the figures we're gathering throughout the district. And then we would take that input from this workshop and the next workshop, and we would bring back on April 17th a summary budget book, our proposed rates, which would be in part of our consolidated schedule rates, fees, and charges, and our proposed Prop 218 notices. At April 17th, we'd be recommending for those proposed rates and requesting the board to approve us to distribute the Prop 218 notices to all of our property owners. When the last time we did this, it was 250,000 mailings. To all of our property owners. We then would, as I mentioned, the Prop 218 notices need to go out, so we're on May 2nd, we'd actually have to have those distributed. On June 19th, we have a scheduled public hearing to adopt the, to have the hearing, get the information input from our ratepayers, just as a reference point. Last time we did this, we had roughly 19 letters. I think we had two speakers, so that was the context we had. So we're looking at having a successful public hearing on the 19th. And then with the board approving the budget and adopting the rates, we would make those effective July 1 for certain rates, the ones that are related to fees and charges, but all the water and sewer rates become effective on January 1 of 2020. So that's our planned schedule. If there's no questions, I'll just dive right into our workshop for today. Great. So first off, I just want to get some level set, the context of what is our budget today and what do we currently spend our funds on. In fiscal year 2018-19, we have $196 million of annual expenditures. This chart here is representing those components of our expenditures. On the right side, you see shaded in the variety of blue colors. Those are our operating expenditures. So roughly half of our expenses are operational related. That includes our purchased water cost, our water operations, our wastewater operations, and our recycled water. So you can get a good sense of our expenditures just from how does it cost to run our business from our operations side. The other left side of this chart is really showing our other components, which are principally related to capital investments. Our large capital investment program takes up a sizable component of this, as well as the debt repayment of our debt to fund that capital investment. And so our CIP currently is around $76 million. Our operating fixed asset is another way of looking at our capital expenditures. That's $34 million. Our debt repayment is roughly $52 million. And then we have an OPEB, other post-employment benefit contribution of $13 million, or payment of $13 million, and then our general administrative expense is $29 million. So that rounds out our budget to date. And then we're going to go through each of these components as part of our assumptions, and then we'll get to kind of a preliminary look of what we're seeing for 2020 and 2021 for this biennial budget. So on slide 5, just want to briefly go through our water sales and supply, a little bit of history. And in all of these graphs, I'm going to do the same. I'm going to give you a little bit of five-year look back or a few years look back, and then our current budget as well as our projections for the next 2 years. Again, these are very preliminary. We're still pulling together all the figures for us to come back and talk about at our next workshop. But we think these are reasonable projections at this point. So fiscal year 1920, we're projecting a 1% increase in water sales compared to our 18 actuals. Those drivers include our demand at Lake Hemet, Western, their Marietta service area, and Paris. And we also assume there's growth because of our new connections. We'll continue to increase our demands. So that's our water sales, around 87,000 acre feet on the potable water side. And then with a higher demand, we're also looking at additional purchased water. You can see in the chart below, overall water supply at 98,000 acre feet. We're projecting purchased water at almost 74,000 acre feet a year for the next 2 years. That's compared to actuals for last year at 70,000. So about 4,000 acre feet of additional purchases from Metropolitan in the next 2 years. Now, if you look at that in a dollars perspective, so water supply costs, this is in the gray bars. You'll see this in the next few slides. The gray is representing our actual. So you can kind of see a trend. I thought this was important given the context of the drought for that we've come through. You can see we went all the way down to $51 million in water supply costs back in fiscal year 16. The drought had us reduce our amount of purchased water. As we've seen some rebounding, we've been purchasing additional water, and we're continuing to see higher demands as we have additional growth as well. We're expecting to see those costs, those overall demands to increase, which is going to drive us to purchase additional water. And these are passing on the rates that Metropolitan has already adopted. They put a postage stamp kind of out there that says they're going to raise rates by 3%. But not everything is equal. We buy different untreated and treated and fixed costs we have to pass through. Based on the numbers we've calculated, we're coming up at a 3% increase for 2020 and a 4% in 2021. So that's what put into these figures here. On water operations, a little more straightforward. What we're seeing based on our preliminary review is that our cost for the next 2 years is going to escalate by roughly 4% each year. This is going to be driven by our increase in chemical, electrical, and regulatory cost. Hypochlorite is going to be a major component to the wastewater treatment side. We'll be buying a lot more chemicals as a district overall, but we also see in the water side additional higher costs for the chemical components. And we're going to come back and talk a little more in detail as we do our budget books and future workshops of the specifics of these components come in. But we anticipate these are going to be the major drivers to increase at a 4% rate in the next 2 years. As I mentioned, wastewater, too, again, a 4% escalation relative to today's budget. Again, hypochlorite is going to be the key driver in that component we anticipated in this year's budget. But for a variety of reasons, those costs didn't come in at this year, but we definitely see those coming in for next year as we implement the safety programs in the other plants. On the recycled water operations, we, again, see about a 4% escalation as our projection for the next 2 years. It's really an inflationary adjustment. As you can see, it's about $7 million, give or take, for the next couple of years, managing our recycled operations. And then now we're going to the other side of the pie chart. This is the capital side. This is still being fine-tuned, but we're thinking it's a reasonable range. I think this graph also helps kind of illustrate that you can almost, finance guys like to simplify things, I guess. Engineers like to give me lots and lots of numbers and lots of detailed projects. But you can almost see a trend by looking at these graphs. If we kind of bounce up and down, but on average, we come out around $80 million a year in capital expenditures. We're right now forecasting or projecting for the next 2 years, $85 and $89 million respectively. I think it looks reasonable relative to what we've been spending on projects the last few years. And then this is the amount of funds that we're contributing, the district is contributing. This excludes the external grant fundings that we receive. So we'll fine-tune these numbers when we come back to our next workshop, but we think this is a good place to start for planning purposes, around $85 million of district expenditures for capital. Our next item is our operating fixed assets. These expenditures include our capital investments in vehicles, IT systems, facility repairs, well and pump refurbishments, and other projects. Some key projects in 20 and 21 include our CIS system, which staff has made briefings to the board in December, a CNG infrastructure and vehicles. We have a larger CI or OFLA budget in current year at $34 million. We have a lot of carryover projects from the prior year that moved into this year. We're anticipating that that number is going to come down into the next 2 years at a $27 million a year level. We do, again, have an annual replacement on the vehicle side. We have an IT investment in the CIS that's going to be spread over several years that we believe can be absorbed within this $27 million budget. We have operating and engineering facility maintenance to continue. And then we also continue to have a small portion of AMI that just will be ongoing maintenance components. But the tapering off the AMI costs will be reflected in this budget since we'll be completing that project in the fourth quarter of this fiscal year. And then on debt service, so as we've talked about many times before, we've done a significant restructuring of our debt portfolio. And it has given us capacity to be able to fund our programs, but also has kind of has re-sculpted our debt service profile. We originally were looking at an excess of $60 million a year in debt service beginning 3 years ago in 2017. We're now looking at that we're going to be creeping up higher over the next couple of years as it relates to the new additional debt that we've issued in the last 3 years. Mainly for the Temecula Treatment Plant. With that expansion, we have a new SRF loan that we're going to have to begin paying back at the completion of the project, and also some other new money series that we issued in 2017. So that debt service amortization is starting to kick in, so you can see it steps up from the $52 million to $58 million, and then again to the $60. Longer-term projections, we kind of go level at $63 million. We should stay at that level for about 15 years. So we're almost to that level. We'll probably be there about 4 years, and then we'll be level at $63 million, assuming interest rates and everything stays about the same. So that's the trend on the debt service. And then on non-operating expenditures, which includes our general administrative components, but also studies and miscellaneous expenses, we're projecting a 4% increase in this area as well. It's $29 million this last year in today's budget. Next year we're projecting $30 million and then $32 million the following year. I wanted to shift gears now. It's been a very important topic for the district is our other post-employment benefits. It's a national kind of discussion about the importance of funding these obligations. So a topic we have with our rating agencies each time we talk with them. And so we've been giving good marks for the efforts that the district has done to ensure the funding of this obligation. But I want to talk a little about the policies that we've developed and how that informs our budget for the next 2 years. I think the last time we did the budget, we sort of put pieces together anticipating it, but we didn't really put together the plan and connect it with the policy principles. So if you don't mind, I'd like to just do that briefly here. So in 2013, we had a strategic plan to talk about the importance of this funding. We set up these policy principles. This table reflects those. The status is just saying that in green that we've done these things, we've implemented these since 2013. But I do want to point out the second row, fully fund actuarial liability by 2034 is our ultimate goal. The third at the bottom is use gains from net operating margin to reduce liability. It's another item we've been using each year as we continue to fund into our trust fund. And then we also want to reevaluate funding biannually with evaluations, and that's what we're also doing with our actuarial studies. So we're doing these things. We think it's important to talk about this as we go and develop our budgets. A little bit of background, though, of like what was the issues? What were we thinking about when we evaluated the OPED liability? Back in 2012, we actually did a study or analysis with PFM's model to forecast OPED liability over the long run. At that time, we were just paying it. We call it PAYGO. You're paying our benefits each year just as it came in. And the numbers are pretty small. They're in $1 million to $2 million a year. But we knew those were going to grow to over $20 million a year over the next 15 to 20 years. And we didn't have funds available or set aside to pay those liabilities. We did an actuarial study, and it determined that liability will continue to grow if you don't set aside funds. This purple line on this graph is actually illustrating that number. So we saw that we would have a nexus of a $200 million liability if we continued down that path. We looked at ways in which we could reduce that. The first thing that we did was we adjusted new hire benefits to the PIMCA-only benefit. That one, the negotiation, adjusted the purple line from $205 million out in 2034 to the green line, which is now $104 million in 2034. That one component made a significant dent in that liability. So we saw there was a lot of benefit from that one contribution or one adjustment. But we also did additional things going forward. We've also budgeted and funded the CERP trust on the annual required contribution limit. We were saying we wanted to get there by 2024. We were able to get there much earlier, and we'll talk about that in a second. That also brought down that liability. And finally, we've made discretionary contributions to the trust in the last 2 years. We made a $5 million and a $7 million contribution. Those additional contributions also helped pay down that liability. And that's what's brought us down to the low blue line, which is our remaining unfunded liability. So you can see it was around $100 million in 2014. It's now at $68 million. So
Charles, just to point out real quickly, as the board will recall, we took the action to invest the money in the California Employee Retirement Benefit Trust because the interest earnings of that trust, which is independently managed by PERS, are substantially higher than we can earn with our investments under our current investment policy. And I think those returns have been actually fairly good over the last 5 years. I think they've been in the 6 to 8%
range.
Yeah, 6 to 8%, depending on which investment selection you make. So that's turned out to be a pretty fortuitous decision, and it's also helped bring down this liability more rapidly. That with also when we did have good budget to actual cycles, we made those additional one-time contributions in which the board directed at the end of those fiscal years.
Yeah. Terrific. So this is what brings us to today. So we're now at around $68 million, much better than where we were projected to go if we did nothing. But we still have some work to do. We put this dashed line in here just to kind of remind ourselves our goal still remains to be 100% funded by 2034. But my personal goal is to see if we can do that even earlier. The earlier we get to this target, the better we're going to have in our ability to have financial flexibility and stability. And where it's prudent, we think it still continues to be a good interest for us to make contributions to pay down this obligation. So a little about how that worked. This is just another graph on slide 16 of this is an actuarial term. It's an actuarially defined contribution. It's what the actuaries say you should pay to pay not only your annual expense, but also to buy down that liability.
Kind of keep up.
Keep pace. So that's the blue line. As you can see, back in 2010, we were well below it with our green line. That's what we're actually paying. So once we established the trust in 2012, we started creeping up on the green line, getting all the way up to paying our actuarially determined contribution in 2015. So once we hit 2015, we achieved that goal, which again we had as a 2024 goal. We were able to get there earlier. But we then decided, you know, if we could pay it down faster, we know there's going to be a lot of financial benefits for the district. So we've made two discretionary contributions, $7 million in 2017 and an initial $5 million in June of 2018. So that, again, helped buy down our liability because it was a very prudent investment, putting those funds into an investment trust. So this next graph is just to illustrate, again, another way of looking at it. This is how we've been adding money into this trust and then bringing down our liability. The dark blue is what the liability is. The light blue is our cash that's in this, it's not cash, but the monies that are sitting in this trust. Those investment trusts holding now $38 million of our contributions over time. So we continue to use that. We continue to contribute to it, and that helps pay down our expenditures. So at this point, given all of these facts, given where we are, and given the policy principles that we've established, we think we could maybe better define some of these targets so that we can use these as trajectory points as we establish our budgets. And what we're looking at is making recommendations to fine-tune this where we would achieve a 60% funded status by 2022, a 70% funded by 2026, 90% by 2030, and then being able to achieve 100% funded status by 2034. This basically brings that line into a little more clear trajectory path, and we continue to fine-tune this as we develop our biennial budget. To do that, staff would then recommend an OPEB contribution of $18 million in 2020 and $19 million in 2021. We're going to work with our actuarial to see if putting these contributions in there is going to help us continue to bring that liability down. We know it will, but the question is to what level. Be able to get that and get the benefit on our financial statements in the next year with these types of contributions. So that's some of the math that we'll work out and be able to talk to at the next workshops. But we think that this is a prudent step and consistent with our policies. And then finally, we have a recommendation of additionally evaluating a contribution for this current fiscal year. We, in this graph, we're showing where we are. Again, we have a $19 million contribution in fiscal year 18. Our budget is $14 million for this current fiscal year. We think that we can make additional contributions for this year, but we're going to wait until March to come back to talk to the board a little bit more about how we're coming through the year and see if our margins are high enough to be able to make what size level contributions. Again, if we follow the pattern, we would make that contribution in June, and then we get the credit of that reflected on our financials for this year. So we'll table that for now, but we do want to plant the seed that that's something that we would like to also entertain for this year.
As you plant the seat, again, as you know in the past, the board has not been shy about making sure that we're keeping up and actually going above staff recommendations on this. So I appreciate your seed planting, but looking at what historically the board has done in the past, I would factor that into your budgeting.
Perfect. Music to my ears. So we'll do that, and we'll have a robust discussion about contributions for this year as well as for contributions for the next 2 years. If you see that additional contributions above the recommendations here, we can talk about that as well if we think that makes more sense for the longer term.
Well, while we're on this, this weekend's Press Enterprise, there was an article about special districts and all the billions they have in excess funds and reserves. Is there any talk again about governor or the state and the legislators introducing bills to try to capture those funds? There was that fear some years ago.
Yeah, when the state was in dire budget circumstances, there was discussions of they would go to special districts and somehow take that along with all their 1% property tax revenues. I think the state's in a different financial position. There's a projected budget surplus at the end of the fiscal year of about $14.8 billion. So I don't think the state's in a position where it would be looking at doing that. Last time that really received a lot of attention, one of the strategies I heard a number of the special districts look at, and I presume we looked at that here, was you would basically, if the state came to raid the reserves, essentially, you would essentially take that money and defease all the bonds. So you wouldn't have any reserves left, and you just basically use it to offset your debt. And when I was at Irvine Ranch, we put those processes in place because we were worried about the same thing, that the state was going to pass legislation to transfer those funds. So there's strategies you could put in place. I don't even think that's close to happening, given the state's fiscal situation right now.
Okay, that sounds good. Maybe next year, though, you'll be discussing it, because based on what our consultants were saying a while ago about the Governor Newsom's proposals and planned expenditures.
Right. Well, and I think the point to the newspaper articles that you saw that on special districts, there was a similar one written by the same reporter in Orange County. That reporter has gone down, you know, and written articles about this before, about special districts and the number of special districts, the reserve levels, the redundant services, and so forth. And so she's just kind of bringing those up again. We have, you know, certainly a very defensible position when you look at our reserve levels. And if we do get inquiries, which we have not, you know, certainly if you look at our construction and our construction requirements, and you consider a lot of those funds are basically bond proceeds where bonds have been sold and put in, and that's money that's going right out to the door to the tune of around $100 million a year for the capital program. You look at our operating reserves relative to our operating budget and realize we also have policies. We also have reserve policies that set these amounts. We think we're in very sound footing.
Okay.
Good. Paul said it so perfectly, I
it's
can't
good.
Add anything to that.
Great.
That's great.
Thank you.
So we'll talk more about OPEB. I appreciate the feedback. So then we conclude with this summary then of, again, these are projections or early figures for the consideration for our budget levels for the next 2 years. We envision that the overall operating expenditures would be about 4% increase for the next 2 years. And then the sizable increases are going to be on the capital side as we continue to make investments, strategic investments in our capital programs. We'll be able to come back to the board and talk about those in more detail at our next workshop. We see about $423 million is a rough number at this point for next year's budget, and it would be around $440 million roughly for the following year. So those are my notes. Again, our schedule is we come back on March 20th for a second workshop to go into more detail, and then come back with a budget book and our rates on April 17th for approval for us to go out and mail those to our property owners. So is there any questions or feedback you'd like to provide us in considering our next workshop with the development of the books, or just any other questions you might have?
I just had one, and on the capital side of things, I know last year we were looking at our vehicles. There's a little bit of a drag time in what we're budgeting, and just, I don't know if Jeff has any update on that, or Charles?
One, we will be coming
I think
back.
Laura, you,
yeah.
Sorry.
Excuse me, Laura.
Just that we have spent the money. I think there was a delay. To plan and order trucks, it takes quite a bit of time with all the equipment, but I've been assured that all the trucks have been ordered and we've spent all of our dollars, but they did get a little behind in previous budgets.
So that kind of that going through the snake, the bubble?
Well, part of it was at that last cycle we were ordering the CNG vehicles, mm-hmm. which had the conversion over the compressed mm-hmm. natural gas, and we had tractors in there and a couple of other vehicles that had a very, very long lead time for us to get. So we did get behind, but Dan Howell, who handles that, has assured us that they're going to be pretty much right on target with the budget.
Okay. Just want to put that out.
Unless Jeff has some more vehicles.
No, the other one I would add was the standby generators.
Oh, right.
We had to purchase several of those units because our large 1,000 kW and up units were no longer approved for
air quality compliant.
Okay. Right.
Which is
but these are not electrically operated, right? They're
correct.
AQMD's one. Yeah. Okay.
Thank you, Charles.
Thank you, Charles.
Great. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Charles.
Okay. With that, then we'll go to agenda item 6, which is receive and file. I'll accept a motion and a second for the approval of items 6A through 6D.
I'll move the item.
It's been moved and seconded. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries 4-0 with director record absent. With that, we will go to agenda item 6, which is calendar review. Nicole.
Good morning, President Sullivan, members of the board. This will be a short calendar review. I have no new events today, so moving to page 2, we have the board's master calendar. Events are listed for between today and the next board meeting, which is March 20th. Beginning with tomorrow, February 21st, we have the board executive committee meeting at 7:30 for Directors Sullivan and Slauson. And at 5:30 p.m. tomorrow, the MoDOT Water Policy Forum will be held in Costa Mesa. Director Pauly is scheduled to attend at 5:30 p.m. along with staff. And on Friday, February 22nd, at 7:30 a.m., the Riverside County Water Task Force speaker series will be held at Western. Director Sullivan is scheduled to attend. Monday, February 25th, at 7:30 a.m., Director Slauson has his monthly update with the general manager in Moreno Valley. On Monday, February 25th, we have the Hemet San Jacinto Water Master Meeting here at EMWD at 4 p.m. Tuesday, February 26th through Thursday, February 28th, Director Sullivan will be attending the Aqua DC conference in Washington, D.C. And he will immediately head to the Multi-State Salinity Coalition's annual Salinity Summit in Las Vegas, Thursday, February 28th to March 1st, and Jeff Wall will be attending as well. February 28th, we have the Board Ops and Engineering Committee meeting at 3:30 p.m. Director Slauson. And on Monday, March 4th at 7:30 a.m., Director Pauly has his update meeting with the General Manager here in Paris. The WR Quad Executive Committee meeting will be held at 2 p.m. on March 4th, Director Slauson. Tuesday, March 5th, the SAFA Commission meeting will be held at 9:30 a.m., Director Sullivan. Thursday, March 7th, we have the Administrative Committee meeting. That's at 4 p.m. for Directors Pauly and Sullivan. On Monday, March 11th, we have the Director Corona has his monthly update meeting with the General Manager at 7:30 a.m. in Temecula. Wednesday, March 13th, Director Sullivan has his update meeting with the General Manager at 7:30 a.m. in Paris. On page 3, we continue with Thursday, March 14th, Director Corona will be attending the Rancho California Water District Board meeting at 8:30 a.m. That afternoon, we have the Board Planning Committee meeting at 3:30 p.m. The Winchester Municipal Advisory Council will meet at 6:30 p.m. on the 14th as well for Director Pauly. On Monday, March 18th, is the next quarterly deferred comp meeting at 7:30 a.m. for Directors Pauly and Swanson. The CalDESAL Executive Committee teleconference will be held at 11 a.m. on Monday, the 18th as well. And Tuesday, March 19th, we have the SAFA Commission meeting at 9:30 a.m. for Director Sullivan. And on page 4, we have some upcoming events listed. Just for your reference, if there are any that you're interested in, please let me know. In the case where the district is sponsoring these events, we may have tickets available. So please let me know if you'd like to attend. The next 3 months of board meetings are listed. On page 5, we have the board committee meetings. Just a note that we are working to reschedule the April 4th admin committee meeting. So we'll get some dates to you for that one. And actually, we are also proposing a move on the March 21st executive committee meeting. The date proposed is March 27th for that one.
Right.
3:30 p.m.?
Yeah.
Okay. So we'll get that moved. The joint committee meetings are listed, as well as the out-of-office schedule and district holidays. Are there any questions or additions on the calendar?
Pre-leave, I am now looking at not being available the 4th through the 6th of March.
Okay.
Which could be a problem for the March 6th meeting. I was talking to Director Sullivan.
Oh, for admin?
No, March 6th board
March
meeting.
6th.
We don't have a
we don't,
meeting.
We're not going to have a
okay,
meeting.
Okay.
Because
okay.
It's a legislative
problem
day.
Solved.
Problem solved.
Problem solved.
I think you should have said anything to him.
Yeah.
Well, make him feel guilty at least,
yeah.
You know.
That is how good our general manager is.
Yeah.
He solved the problem. So
very quickly.
I just will not be here. So we could at some point maybe reschedule the meeting on the 4th with general manager. That's easily solved. So
yeah, we can do
that. Okay, perfect.
Thank you.
Thank you, Nicole.
Okay, with that, we'll go to calendar review.
Oh, we just said that.
With the board.
Oh, with
board attendance reports. Director Corona.
Okay. All right, so on February 11th, I had my meeting with the general manager and a very informative meeting. On the 2nd, February 13th, I attended a little briefing with staff on the Golden Triangle sewer situation and kind of give me an idea what had gone on before. And then right after that, I attended a meeting with the property owners and staff. I think it was a very good meeting. I think we got some things accomplished, and we're looking forward to getting some more information from the property owners, and I guess that's squared away. The water district meeting, that was the day of the big rain, and I gave a little presentation of the stuff that's going on with the sewage treatment plant, not the destructive stuff that was going on with the sewage treatment plant. But the new additions, the sewage treatment plant, airline, the gas line, and the fact that we're having to throw away a bunch of reclaimed water, unfortunately, but can't be helped. At the time, I drove to the district, at some places on Murrieta Creek between Rancho California Road and Winchester Road, towards L&M Fertilizer, and that there's that dip crossing and across. I think the water level was about 3 feet from getting to the road on the other side, so it was pretty high. I can imagine how bad it would be if you recall back in 1993 when Old Town flooded and there was no removal of tules and stuff and Temecula Creek, how bad it would have been the other day. I would imagine it would probably have been not quite as bad, but I think it definitely would have pressed the water. And the section below Ranch California Road, the new flood control project worked beautifully, and I was actually surprised how much water was in there. I mean, it was, I think that those walls are 30 feet high, and they were probably 8-10 feet from the top. So, and I think it probably would downstream. You know, you go back to natural habitat, and I think that just helps slow everything down again. So, and raise the water. So, yeah, that's my report.
Great. Okay, Director Pauly.
Sure. Southern California Water Committee luncheon, I unfortunately was not able to make that. Had a good bi-monthly update with General Manager. Ron and I were able to attend the BIA economic forecast within the Empire, which was very interesting. Dr. Doty says that we're in good shape out here, so I'm going to believe him. Did a good event out at Temecula Prep on our water bill, water bottle filling stations. Did a little photo op that I think I myself and some of the kids out there are going to be in some materials for the district. Again, I love our water bottle filling station program, and as that works its way through all our schools in the district. CalDESAL Executive Committee meeting on February 6th was well for some planning. We also did a CalDESAL conference that Jeff was out there in the Coachella Valley area. We also took a very interesting tour of the Salton Sea with Phil Rosentrader, who led that. A lot of good, interesting things going on there.
Checking the date.
I had a teleconference with the Water Master Auditor. My comments were making sure that we're following our investment policy for the cash reserves at the Water Master, which I'm sure that we are. Had a good meeting with our Deputy General Manager. I've always enjoyed that. Brought her up to speed on some things I'm interested in at the district. And as Director Corona indicated, a good meeting with the Golden Triangle investors. And again, I just want to say, Joe, you do such a good job in those meetings. They brought back some very interesting proposals, and Paul and Joe. I know one of the investors gets a little boisterous, but very good job of assuring them the district's on top of things. So I always appreciate that.
Thank you.
And that concludes my report.
Okay. I did attend the Santa Ana Watershed Project Authority's presentation to the Regional Water Quality Control Board with Mark Norton and Rich Howler. It was an excellent presentation. The board was very receptive to what the watershed's doing. Appreciate that. It was nice also to see Jane Joy, and she's obviously loving what's going on over there. I went to the Paris 2 community briefing, which I thought was always well done by the PGA staff. No golf, Dave, and was a nice presentation for those that are still interested in what goes on over there in the community, which
is obvious that we do an incredible outreach. Even though the weather was bad, we've had representation out there before with many, many more people. And so this is really a credit to the staff at Public Affairs. Also, actually, I did attend, because I got invited at the last minute to attend the groundbreaking of the Liberty High School that is just off of Scott Road and Leon Road. There must have been, in the heavy rain, there and in tents, there was probably 120 people there trying to nestle in to stay out of the rain. And EMWD got a lot of notoriety because most all the schools were there, and they absolutely love the fill stations, the water fill stations. You know, how much they did talk about that, you know, I thought was a real salute to what we do here. And then yesterday attended the SOPA commission meeting, and a wonderful presentation by Craig Miller from Western on the Santa Ana River Water Master, and you know what happens on the river, how much water comes in, you know what the baselines are. It was something I had never seen before, and I don't think anybody else on the commission had ever seen that before. It was kind of an eye opener for everybody, and well done by Craig. We did adopt the OWOW plan for 2018 on a 4-1 vote. Orange County decided they would say no. We did talk about some of the weather and how it affected the brine line. This is the first time we had heavy rains that we did not have a lot of infiltration and have to pay for the flow going down to Orange County Sand District, and that's attributed to the slip linings that they did out of IEUA over to the brine line. And we talked a little bit about the budget, and then we had a interesting meeting on the OWOW commitment from Orange County. So that there'll be a little ad hoc committee that will help straighten this out, we hope. So that's my comments. And, whoops, before I get that away, Director Slauson, did you have?
He didn't have
anything. No.
He didn't have anything.
No, it's fine.
You were just working a lot.
I'm just, yeah, hanging at home. Hanging
okay. Steve, we have reason for closed session today.
Yes, we do, Mr. Chair. We have two items pursuant to Government Code Section 549.56.9, one item of potential litigation and one item of pending litigation, San Diego versus Metropolitan.